Sachin, is your waitlist ready?
Let's do this. Welcome to our podcast. I'm Sachin.
I'm Medic, and you're listening to...
Let Me Clear My Throat.
So look at here. Check the flavor of the rhythm I wrote. And while I get a chance here, let me clear my throat. Oh! Have mercy, baby. Ha! I hope you don't mind. Let me clear my throat.
All right, so we're excited for our first episode. We brought a guest who's actually a foreign correspondent for the Wall Street Journal, currently lives in Bogota, Colombia, and he's actually a cousin of my partner in this podcast, Nythic, and the name of our guest today is Kajal. And what we're going to be talking to him about is just pretty interesting stuff about his career path as a journalist, you know, usually starting, we started kind of a traditional Indian Bindi path, which was in kind of the medical field, but he kind of diverted and went into journalism. So what we want to talk to him about and what we explore in this podcast is basically his career path, but also just interesting questions about how does one actually achieve a position like foreign correspondent in Bogota, Colombia, covering rebel groups, you know? So I think it was a super interesting podcast. It's going to be part one. We were talking about his career path. Part two, which you'll listen to later, is more about the Colombia stuff, but we're really excited about it. Hope you enjoy it.
All right. Well, we're talking to Kajal today, and he's somewhere in Bogota. And why don't we just let him introduce himself? Kajal, what are you doing in Bogota? How did you end up there? Let's start from there.
All right. Well, yeah, I'm Kajal. I currently do live in Bogota. Maybe right about that.
Wouldn't I get three Indian guys walking around in Bogota?
Yeah, there's not too many. At least not that I've met so far. But yeah, no, I've been here for just a handful of months. I'm a journalist. I report for the Wall Street Journal. I was their Venezuela correspondent for a little more than five years, and finally got a chance to leave, and now in Colombia.
All right. Well, so obviously the first thing that would have, you know, you're a pretty non-Bindi job. So that's fascinating, Leica. And how did you not fall into... So before we jump into what you're doing now and here, just to kind of cover, how did you not fall into your standard engineer, doctor, computer science routine of every other Bindi that we know?
Actually, I'm going to take a step back for a second, because just the Bindi related, I only know of one other Bindi journalist, and he works for the Wall Street Journal. Do you know Sudeep Reddy? Because I fuck with Sudeep Reddy.
Yeah, I mean, I've met him on a couple of occasions, actually. Yeah, actually. But I mean, I wouldn't say we unfortunately never got like to work together or anything. But yeah, I definitely know who he is.
Can you tell him that I want to hang out with him in D.C.? Because I fucking listen to him on Marketplace all the time, and I love him.
Yeah, I'll pass him that message.
All right. Back from my obsession with Bindi journalism, I guess. But back to the question ahead, which is, how did you end up in journalism, but not the traditional Bindi path of engineering or doctorhood?
Well, actually, I kind of did at first. I went to Rutgers in New Jersey, and I remember in high school, I think I don't think anybody ever pressured me to go into the health sciences field, but I think I just assumed that was my role in life, and so I at first applied for the Rutgers pharmacy program, which is like a 6-year pharmacy doctorate program. So I did that for like a year and a half, and during which time I was also counting pills at a CVS, and I just realized it wasn't for me. And I think I had taken like a journalism class as like an elective my second year, and I was like, yeah, this is really what I want to do. I was always kind of a news nerd and wanting to learn about the world, and I love like travel documentaries and all that kind of stuff. And I used to be a huge like Bill Maher fan in high school. And so I remember like I used to every day watch his Politically Incorrect show, and then like go into class and like debate with like have classmates. So that was like always my obsession, my passion. So I decided to make a career of it and jumped in with two feet. You know, folks, my parents weren't too happy, but at first, but you know, I guess they came around after I was lucky and got like a part-time reporting gig at the New York Star Ledger, Tony Soprano's old paper. And yeah, I mean, it was starting out writing like community profiles and whatnot, but kind of sticking around and making enough coffee for editors and answering, you know, phones. You know, they give me stuff to do. And just one thing left to another. And I was also managing my campus newspaper or helping to manage my campus newspaper. Yeah, and that's how I kind of got into this.
Wait, so you fully transitioned to journalism as a major then at Rutgers?
Yeah, my second year. Yeah, I got to tell you, my parents were really... I still remember my dad... Nathan's heard about this. But my dad... When I told him that I was like switching all my classes to like the liberal arts, he's like, can't tell you do what you want.
But it's hard. It's growing up with Cato. He did get that like about on a weekly basis. So it's hard to distinguish which one was which. But yeah.
Which one was going to result in a beating and which one was just going to be verbal accosting.
I don't think it was ever beating, but it was like the utter disappointment.
Couple decades after any meetings were to happen, when my dad says do what you want, you know you're in trouble, and he's clearly not happy. I actually took on a double major of journalism and history, so I don't think either of them really made him too happy, but whatever.
So when you started that your second year and you were working, it was the New York Star Ledger, you said, right?
Newark.
So then you did that. How long did that last? And like, did you do that to graduation and stuff or what?
Yeah, well, I did that like for like, I think a year and a half. I was like going to Rutgers, Newark campus. And then, you know, after classes, I would just go to the end of the street. It was pretty close by and, you know, work till nighttime. And yeah, that was like a year and a half, and then I went to study abroad. Since I was kind of in this very free spirit moment, I guess, I went to study abroad for a year in India, which was amazing, great experience. And then I guess that was a pretty Bindi thing, right? I don't know.
Is it? I don't know. I feel like I would not have ever done it.
No, it's actually interesting because when I was deciding on where to go abroad, I actually looked up going to India, to Delhi specifically too, and then... It was like a weird like internal discussion I had because I was like, is it Bindi or is it actually very American to do?
Yeah, that's pretty interesting because actually I remember in my group there was 10 people or something from Rutgers who went like through Rutgers University, and then there was like another 8 people from Brown University, and so I remember like, you know, the group was mostly, you know, I guess white folks, and there was like a handful of people like myself, or, you know, first generation, you know, born to Indian parents in the U.S., I guess like rediscovering their roots kind of thing. There was far fewer of those than, you know, other Americans of all different kinds.
And were you focused on journalism when you were in that program, or was it just a general liberal arts thing?
No, it was just a general liberal arts thing. I actually focused on learning Urdu. And I mean, I did learn how to write and read and which I still know how to, and I defend myself with very basic language skills, but they've kind of slowly faded, unfortunately, because of lack of use.
Yeah, I figure Urdu doesn't come up very often in Caracas, but
it didn't, unfortunately. I mean, actually, you know what? There were a lot of, not a lot, I would say, but there's kind of a small kind of Indian expat community, mostly like people who work for multinationals and whatnot, who like pharmaceutical companies and some engineering firms and oil companies. So there's a hand, there's like, you know, you can find them, but yeah, there's not like a, yeah, it wasn't that useful for that.
So it's just because you two are the only two people I've ever met that have spoken about Delhi and specifically in a favorable or neutral light, I feel like you had a pretty interesting experience like in Delhi, almost to the point where you didn't want to come back, or your 6-month program that went into like what? You ended up being there like well over a year, to the point where the family was going to send me to pick you up. I don't know what good that was going to do, but can you talk about a little bit about that? And I think maybe if you can add in your experience about Delhi and sure, this,
You have to bear in mind that, you know, I went on a study abroad program. So as a student, I was living at home prior to that, you know, I was commuting to school. And so this was like kind of my one big year of like, you know, living away, living away. So it was, there was certainly a big party element. And so my experience, you know, is very heavily influenced by me having no responsibilities and, you know, being allowed to kind of just explore India on my own and with friends. Yeah, it was a tremendous experience. You know, I would say I learned a lot more outside the classroom than inside the classroom, but one thing, I guess, from like the Bindi American perspective, like, I guess when you're, I guess this happens to a lot of immigrant communities, but, you know, when you grow up in an immigrant household and, you know, you're taught about, you know, here's what the old country is like and, you know, this and that, and you also have your interactions with your family members, you know, like, that's your entire image of the old country. And yeah. So I went there like thinking, oh my God, I know so much about India. I had taken like, I remember a bunch of like Indian history classes in university. And
it's like, I'm a fucking expert on partition.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Like some of that. And also, you know, I speak Gujarati and, you know, I have like, at least I understand Hindi and all that kind of stuff. And so I felt like, you know, oh man, you know, here I am, like, you know, an Indian representative or something, you know, and like you go there and you're like, damn, I'm so gringo. So it was such a good, like, kind of wake up call. And like, kind of, so yeah, I know it's cliche, you know, everybody getting to learn about yourself and whatnot, but I really, like, for me, it was kind of like, yeah, you know, I'm not like Indian or,
yeah.
or anything like that. So I'm like totally shaped by the U.S. And I don't know. I mean, I think there's also something in like U.S. culture that also, like, everybody, you know, you ask anybody on the street, like, oh, where are you from? You know, how many people are going to say I'm American, you know? And even if they do say that, you probably kind of look at them like, ah, what a lame ass, you know? So yeah, like, everybody always wants to like distinguish themselves and say, you know, there's so much pride in where you come from and all that kind of stuff.
Well, I think it's actually what you're talking about. There's two things that reminds me of that are, at least I think, interesting, because one is the element where you were saying that, you know, if you're going back to India to live, for example, but you've grown up in the US, you know, the son of, or, you know, child of immigrants, like, you have this concept of India and you're going to try to like match it to your experience real time, like on the ground in India. But the problem with that, at least my experience, is that, like, so like my parents came from India in the 70s, right? And when they came, although they came separate and alone, but like they formed a community of people in Virginia, for example, that were all Punjabis, right? And so they only hung out with Punjabis, and they all came over in the 70s. And up until even current, like today, they've existed within that framework, and that to them is India.
Yeah,
right?
It's encapsulated.
It's literally a time capsule, yeah, to 1970s India. So when I grew up, like, say, 80s, 90s, I learned about India from within that 1970s capsule, right? And, like, they still live in it. And then you show up in India, and, like, so I've spent a lot of time, like, from 2009 onward. Like, I go every year, at least for a few months. And it's, like, I think about some of the things that they, like, have taught me growing up, or even, like, real-time commentary. Like, if I'm in Delhi and, like, talking to my parents who are, like, in the D.C. area, they're, like, what are you doing? And I, like, told them what I'm up to, and they're, like, oh, like, you should, like, actually, I have a concrete example of it. Like, I, like, was in Delhi, and I was like, oh, I'm going to go meet up with some friends. Oh, where are you going? We're going to Khan Market. My mom's like, don't go to Khan Market. I'm like, why not? That's a Muslim market. Like, that's dangerous. And it's like, what the fuck are you talking about? It's like a goddamn expat market, right? Like,
yeah, it's actually, like, I mean, when I was there, it was like, that's where you would go to, like, find all the white people.
Right. It's where me, as the person who thinks he knows India but wrote, like, truly is gringo, feels comfortable, right? You know? Like, and she, like, my parents' view on it is, like, no, like, that's a Muslim thing, because they have this 1970s, like, oh, we grew up post-partition, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, no, like, things are different. Girls wear tank tops, you know?
Like, yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, no, I completely understand that. Like, I was, when I compare, like, I guess my India experience to then, like, talking to my parents now, like, it's, you know, yeah, their whole experience and everything that they kind of taught to us was very local. I mean, like, you know, my dad now always tells me, like, oh, yeah, you've seen more of India than I have. Like, you know, every time he goes back, he, like, never leaves Ahmedabad, you know, in Gujarat.
Right.
Like, that's, like, and that's also, like, where he, lived his entire life when he did live there before he moved to the States in 1970. And so, yeah, it's like a very regional view. And yeah, it's certainly not, you know, when you're growing up, yeah, as it turns out, you know, not all of India speaks Gujarati.
But it's like, yeah, that's true.
People like in fact, stop. I don't know, I thought people were kind of like, you know, when you tell them, oh, you're from Gujarati descent, it's like, oh, you know.
So, yeah.
Oh, but like, yeah, no, it's crazy. What are you gonna say?
Yeah, no, I would kind of just agree, like, in terms of like, just Gujarat being very, again, it's still one of the two states in India where there's still active prohibition, right? So, right. Like, so when I first went to India, I noticed that people drink, and not only they drink a lot in India.
Yeah,
and. Again, my parents have a very binary view of drinking. Either you don't drink or you're drunk all the goddamn time. So like every time people decide, like I have a beer in front of them, like, oh my God, you don't drive. Like
you either don't drink or you're Punjabi drunk.
Actually, can I say something about the alcohol?
No, please, yeah.
Oh, no. I had this like one funny experience when I was there. One time, like during some break from the school that I was studying at, I went to go visit my uncle in Surat in Gujarat. And I remember it was his birthday, and my cousin was like frying up some samosas. And my uncle was like, "Hey, you want a beer?" And I was like, "Yeah, of course, you know." And so he goes into his closet. And he whips out a couple like Kingfishers, you know, and with some ice cubes. I think we're drinking some Kingfishers and eating samosas. And then at some point, he's like, "Hey, you want Johnny Walker?" And I'm like, "Yeah, sure. Well, why not?" And so we're celebrating here. So he goes back to the closet and gets a bottle of Johnny Walker, and then comes back and pours it straight into my beard. So I think, I don't know, I could be totally wrong about this. My perception was that, like, because of the whole prohibition culture, it's like distorted. You know, how people drink, perhaps. Like, it's
I think that's universally recognized for, like, any form of prohibition, right? Like, when you talk about that with, like, weed in the U.S. and, like, or even just drinking that. Like, you know, like, we had a prohibition in the U.S. and it led to the concept of speakeasies and people drinking fucking, what's it called? Moonshine.
Moonshine, yeah. Going like, blind and shit.
Yeah, like, going blind and shit. It's like...
Yeah, some metal.
Yeah, exactly.
Which still happens in Gujarat, like on a like weekly basis. So that's a good point while we're talking about drinking. So, like, India is a terrible beer place, right? Like, it's 120 fucking degrees. Nobody has a cold beer anywhere. I don't know if it's a supply chain issue where they can't keep that shit cold, but everybody fucking loves Johnny Walker and tends to have Johnny Walker all the time. But, like
people finished... like two handles of Johnny Walker at my party last night.
Yeah.
I was just like, Jesus.
Wait, you were in Ahmedabad last night?
I was hanging out with your uncle, actually. We were pouring the Johnny Walker red straight into the beer.
Unfortunately, he passed away.
Damn it, man.
Well, like, so let's fast forward it out. Like, so, like, you come back from India. Like, how do you transition into, like, getting a degree, and journalism is a tough place to get a job right about now. People are fucking laying off shit all over the place. So how did you not only land a job, and one could say your ideal job, I don't know, like, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like you found your fit. So can you take us through that?
Yeah, sure. Well, all right. Well, yeah, I mean, I got back from India, and then I went back to working for the Star Ledger. They gave me another kind of report, what they call like a... just like a newsroom clerk in another office of the Star Ledger more towards the western part of New Jersey. And so I was like still working at my campus newspaper. I continued that when I got back, and I, you know, keep going with the Star Ledger as well. And so, yeah, afterwards, I you know, did all the things I needed to do to graduate. And I had like a period of maybe 6 months, maybe a little less, I'm not sure, after I graduated, where I was like just kind of you know, spraying my resume into the dark, you know, and you're spot on when you say it's hard. It's definitely a very competitive field, and, you know, obviously knowing people helps and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, I was lucky. I never in college or never in my, you know, schooling did I ever, like, had I even thought about, like, financial journalism, you know, like, writing for, you know, about finance and economics and all that kind of stuff. It just never really crossed my mind. I think I had, like, dreams of being like a war correspondent or something. I was lucky. And so I think like one of the few areas that were still hiring when I was, you know, applying for jobs was, you know, you had, you know, a lot of like big financial news agencies, like, you know, like Dow Jones, which was who hired me. Dow Jones is the owner of the Wall Street Journal. And in turn, Dow Jones is owned by News Corp. But yeah, like it was very tough, but I luckily got like kind of an entry level gig at Dow Jones, and they, you know, needed people to, you know, do these, basically these kind of like reports that go out like really early in the morning for investors and, you know, people who subscribe to their financial news service about, you know, what are the big hot stocks on the stock market, you know, and every day. And I mean, it's a job that kind of starts really early in the morning. It's probably not the most popular job. I don't even think it exists anymore in the same way that it used to. But yeah, like it was, again, not something I had envisioned doing, but damn, I learned so much and it like opened up a whole new world. And so I did that for like approximately 3 years around New York, doing mostly markets coverage and just learning about, you know, just the ABCs of economics. Like I really didn't know anything about economics, and it was just a great crash course on all that stuff. And then when I wanted to travel, I, you know, spoke to my bosses, and I had been like writing about like developing economies in New York for like almost about a year and a half by that point. And I wanted to travel, and my boss was like, I think I was like crossed between like two different opportunities. There was like an opening in Singapore, and my direct boss offered me a opportunity for the Venezuela gig. And I still remember, like, another editor of mine over there, I consulted him. He's like, I told him between these two options, you know, what do you think? And he's like, yeah, like, Kato, you don't, you go to Singapore, you know, it's a great place, but, you know, you're going to be doing mostly markets coverage and you're going to be staring at charts all day. You know, he's like, if you want action, you know, I would say go to Venezuela. And yeah, boy, he was right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Wow, man, what a fucking amazing advice! Like, I don't think
I know. I
mean, I'm so jealous.
Well, like, it's amazing advice, but like, is that like legitimately how you got the job in Caracas?
Like, I'm sorry, what, repeat
is
that.
Like, is that how you transitioned into your job going to Venezuela?
Yeah, that was it, basically. I mean, but, we also kind of required me to promise my editors that I could pick up Spanish really fast. So yeah,
but like, I'm just shocked because I would have imagined that was like a pretty prized position, like that there were probably like a lot of people with conceivably more experience than you, like going for that position. Or am I wrong about that?
Yeah, I don't think it was that hard to find. I mean, I don't think it was that easy for them to find people who want to go there. And I actually, if I'm not mistaken, having, you know, lived there 5 years and, you know, knowing many of the different, you know, folks who work for news agencies based in Caracas, like, you know, it's hard for them to find people who want to come to Venezuela. It's, you know, it's not the easiest place to live. And yeah, I mean, I think they hired two people, myself and my then colleague. We both went to Venezuela at the same time. And yeah.
That's crazy.
At this point, you had never been to like Latin America, right? Am I right?
No, that's not true. I had been to Nicaragua and Colombia, but on backpacking trips.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha. And you didn't have a handle on Spanish or like?
No, not at all. No, that I kind of learned as I went along in Caracas. Yeah.
So
well, I'm sitting here just being like, that's all I wanted to do was live in Latin America and like. I didn't necessarily want to be a journalist, but I was like looking for jobs that would take me, and I couldn't find anything. So I'm sitting here like, fuck.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, it's funny. Just a couple nights ago here, I was at some expat gather. Oh, it was to watch the USA Colombia match. And I met a bunch of guys, like a bunch of, you know, guys from the UK who you know, were telling me about, you know, somehow many people there were just, had just moved on a whim to Colombia and looking for jobs and stuff. Yeah, I mean, it's not the easiest thing. I mean, some of them obviously did get lucky and got, you know, teaching English jobs and whatnot. But yeah, it's tough.
So, I mean, you know, I think Colombia actually suits, I mean, sorry, Venezuela actually suits you, right? It has like that color, like it's the dysfunction almost, like it kind of works with your advantage, like, because you've lived in India and stuff like that. But like, when you go, so you get there and you're like, what was your first like, holy fuck, I am in Venezuela and I'm here, like miles away from any network or anything like that, that I grown up with. And I, oh yeah, I don't fucking speak the language. Did you have that moment?
Well, no, not really. I mean, look, like I used to speak Italian, and so
how many goddamn languages do you speak, man? Jesus Christ!
Well, the Italian was the only non-explainable one. I mean, it is explainable because I learned it in school and in high school rather. And so,
not to shit on your experience, but pretty nonsensical language to learn in high school. It's like learning German too. It's like there's three places on earth that speak this.
But they also still continue being pretty big economies and stuff. So like,
true. Like my sister studied German, and I was like, "Do you have any interest to move to Germany?" And she's like, "No." Like, why did you learn German?
Just in case they start taking over the world again.
Exactly. Or you have some particular crazy, weird interest in Nazism.
I think I took it just like so I could be different, you know? Kind of like, because
thought it'd get you laid or something.
Right? No, like everybody takes Spanish, and then like, you know, then you have like some nerds that take French. And
but at least like French, it's like, okay, well, they did pretty well at colonization. So you can go pretty much anywhere in Africa and be okay with it.
I wasn't looking at it that logically. No, I mean, I think I just took it randomly, really, to be honest. And so, but I stuck with it. And like, I took it for like 5 years. So I had a pretty good grip on it. And that helped me a ton with Spanish.
Of course,
I could read everything, like, or most things. I could just read and figure them out. It just took like a few months to get like conversational and, you know, get a grip on local vocabulary and that kind of stuff.
All right. Well, so did you have a moment where you're like, oh man, this is real. Like, I'm in Venezuela and this country is, you know, less than functional on most normal things, like day-to-day life-wise.
Not really, to be honest. Like, you know, that was one of the things that I did really love about Venezuela is that it's pretty diverse and it's had like a culture of immigration for quite a long time. And so there's pretty large populations of like people from Lebanon, from Syria. You have the, you know, obviously the Europeans who came to Venezuela. You have people mixed in with the indigenous folks. Then you have, you know, the descendants of African slaves. And so it's a pretty big hodgepodge. And so like, there's also tons of like Chinese that also live there as well. And so I never really felt like, oh, you know, like everybody's looking at me because it's obvious that I'm foreigner or something. You know, I don't recall any real moments, like wake up moments, like in that sense. And I also had like the advantage of a somewhat of a support network. There was, you know, a handful of journalists who I became good friends with were either in the same boat as me, you know, as correspondents or, you know, just passing through or, you know, it helped kind of developing like a network of friends. And so that made things a lot smoother.
That's interesting, and both, since both of you have spent some solid amount of time in Latin America, you in Argentina, and Gabriel, you in Venezuela and Colombia, does it help as a Bindi guy walking around be able to just blend in like into predominantly brown countries?
Yeah,
is there an advantage to that, or is that
mine was a little bit different because Argentina is a lot more fair skinned. Like, there's so much more European influence there. So, like, I would see people all the time that I thought were legitimately white people, like Americans, and it's like, oh, you're just Argentine. But, like, mine was, I think the advantage I had from the Bindi brown side was more that, and because my Spanish was, like, you know, like, to use an offensive term, but slightly retarded, like, everyone just thought I was Brazilian.
Yeah.
So it was like, not, oh, he's not American. And I was like, sure. Like, I would just go with that. You know, and like, so for the most part, yeah, I kind of felt the same way. Like, there, I didn't never really had a lot of, like, people looking at me or whatever. I actually think I stood out less in Argentina than I do in India, honestly.
Oh.
That, like, I actually really do think that.
Or is that just, like, the staring culture of India?
No, that's true. That's actually a big part of it. But I think it's, yeah, I mean, I think there's, yes, I think it's part of the creep culture in India, but for sure. But I think in India, the difference, too, is that, like, I look the same, but I, like, dress and, like, you know, my haircut's different. And it's just, like, I don't know. But that's,
yeah, I mean, that's a great point. I mean, like, yeah, because, like, you know, obviously this part of in Latin America, you know, it's, you know, very, very Western in terms of, you know, how people dress and,
right,
and many kind of culture and traditions and all that stuff. And so you don't really, you know, you wear your jeans and T-shirt here and, like, no one's really going to, you know, really give a shit. But if you're, you know, like, if you kind of look like somebody in your Indian village, but, you know, are dressed a little off, or you might, like, kind of attract a little more attention, perhaps, you know?
No, I'm with you. I think it's more free-flowing conversation. But, like, anyway, so I think one of my favorite stories you tell about Venezuela is this very patriotic Venezuelan Korean guy. And, like, that you befriended. And I feel like that's
amazing.
Yeah, that's a good story. And then we can get into a little
podcast. Sure. Yeah, that guy, what a great guy. He, being Bindi and living in Latin America, I mean, I'm sure first thing most people complain about is the food. And when I say Latin America, I mean, you know, south of Mexico. Like, you know, in South America, you know, they're not exactly known for very powerful flavors or anything. And so I obsessively used to eat at a Korean restaurant that was on my street. I think I used to eat there like three times. Maybe I think the most I ever went was like maybe four times in 1 week, you know, twice on the same day kind of thing. And anyway, I was eating there all the time. For me, it was the only food that had flavor. And so,
definitely.
Yeah, I became like really good friends with, or I mean, I became pals with the guy who ran the place. And, you know, he was a young guy. And when I first met him, you know, we started talking, and actually I think he spoke to me in English, if I'm not mistaken. And the guy spoke English with like an absolute, like, perfect American accent. And I'm thinking in my head, yeah, this guy's got to be from like Fort Lee, New Jersey or something. You know, yeah, huge Korean population or something. And it's like one day I'm like, where are you from? And he's like, oh, I'm from here. And I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, yeah, man, I'm totally Venezuelan. I went to American school, and, you know, that's all. And,
oh, damn.
Yeah, it was pretty impressive. But anyway, like, in the years that I knew him, at some point in the middle, like, he told me, oh, he's like, my parents are sending me to Korea. And they're like, you're not coming back until you don't have a, oh, you're not coming back unless you have a girlfriend or a college degree. and he came back, like, I don't even know how many months later, but definitely wasn't like, it wasn't that long. Must've been like 6 or 7 months or something. And he comes back and I'm like, what happened? He's like, I had to come back. He's like, I missed my country. You know, like, I'm Venezuelan and this and that. And, you know, this guy's like coming back to like this country that's like, you know, every day getting more and more dangerous, more and more difficult to live in because of like the food shortages and all that kind of stuff. But like, I don't know, just like kind of seeing that experience, like seeing that guy like so proud of where he was born. And it's funny, like on the streets, like everybody would just call him Gino, you know, like Chinese. You know? Like, nobody really takes the time to realize what the difference is between a Korean person and a Chinese person. But yeah, he's pure Venezuelan, man. And like, and now that just kind of filled me with so much, like, it made me so happy that, you know, like this guy is just so proud of where he comes from. And I don't know, it was just like, it was a nice moment. I don't know. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome. I think so. While you're there, you know, a lot of shit's happening. Chavez is running the country, and he's pretty, you know, polarizing figure worldwide. Like, it's so you're writing a lot, and you're obviously covering Chavez. Any like top level moments of covering Chavez? What that did for your career, or like anything that you can talk about that in relation?
Sure. Well, look, I mean, look, I'll say covering Chavez was just like, you know, an amazing experience. I forgot to mention one thing earlier when we were talking about the the language issue. Like, you know, like Hugo Chavez, like effective, you know, in some way actually taught me Spanish, you know, like, cause I, my job when I got there was, you know, as all the financial news wires do, like Reuters, Bloomberg, Dow Jones, you know, you're kind of, you have, anytime like the head of state is talking, you know, you should be listening. And, you know, you should be looking for any kind of clues of, you know, future policy and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, and perhaps in any other country, it's you know, it maybe a 9-to-5 thing where, you know, you're not, you know, kind of losing, you know, dedicating your entire life to that. But, you know, Hugo Chavez, like, loved to talk, you know. I mean, he had his, like, Sunday television show called Alo Presidente, Hello President, and it was like a call-in show, and he would just talk and sing and whatnot for, like, you know, 5-6 hours easily. And so, like, I had to, like, watch all of that. And that's on top of, like, him just randomly coming on TV any day at any hour during the week, you know? And so I just was, like, glued to the TV watching the guy. And that's kind of how I learned Spanish. And
that's crazy. That's amazing.
I mean, career-wise, yeah, it was just an absolute, like, gold mine because, you know, in Venezuela, the country is just so – there's just so many wacky things going on all the time that, you know, the newspapers just gobble it up. You know, I mean, Venezuela makes the headlines probably more than many other countries in this region. And
so you must have covered his death in 2013 then too, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. I actually had very bad luck covering the major moments and towards the end of his life, because I still remember when he announced that he had cancer, I was like in the middle of a soccer game. And I was playing in the league there. And yeah, I remember getting off like at full time. It was like a Wednesday night or something. I can't remember, but I remember going off the field and like going to my phone, checking my phone, and like 40 missed messages and like all these, and like, you know, like 40 missed calls and, you know, all these like, you know, like several dozen messages and like, you know, my heart just sank and like, oh shit, what the fuck. And thankfully I had a colleague at that time, and so him and another editor of mine handled it. But like, yeah, I totally missed his epic like kind of announcement of his. And then I remember the day he died, like there were so many rumors going on, and I was like glued to my television all day. And it was like around 5 or 5:30 p.m. and I'm like, yeah, you know, I, you know, the things are kind of getting a little hairy. You know, there's a lot of, you can almost like kind of feel the tension in the air. Like the whole country was like, you know, what has happened to the president? He just disappeared. He's like in Cuba getting treatment, and like there's very little like scarce information. You know, some other government ministers like read out like a report on his like health, like his status every day or every other day. And so like everyone's like, oh, something's going to happen. You know, something's going down. This is all very weird. And, anyway, so like that day, like I was like, oh, let me, you know, since everything's kind of looking a little hairy, I'm just gonna go out and get some cash, you know, just in case, you know, in case anything happens. So I'm, like, while I'm standing at the ATM, in front of me happens to be some girl who's on like the state propaganda channel, and she's like glued to her. At some point in the long line, as there is for everything, and the girl's like checking her phone, and she's like jaw drops. And again, she's just like kind of like all panicky and smooth, and I recognize it. I'm like, oh man, that's a bad sign. And then, so then like seconds later, I noticed that, you know, the whole network, like the whole like kind of network crashes. Like you can't make calls. You can't check email. And like, I don't, like, only one email seemed to get through to me, which is like, you know, Hugo Chavez has died. And I'm like, no. and then so I'm like sprinting back to my apartment, which is only like a 2 blocks away, but I'm sprinting back. And I remember like I had like a big ass beard at this time and like long hair, right? And so like these like day workers like going home from their jobs decided to like, you know, have some fun with me. And they're like something, I can't remember what they said. There's something about like terrorists or Al Qaeda or something.
They're fucking racist bastards everywhere.
Yeah, and I'm just like, fuck you. And I'm like, give me the finger as I'm running. Like, I didn't even stop, you know? And yeah, then it was, oh my God, that was a long night. But yeah. Yeah, no, I got to cover a lot of that stuff. And so, yeah, I did, like, journalistic, like, career-wise, yeah, huge boost. You know, social life-wise, maybe not so much, because it, like, restricted what you could do and whatnot. But yeah.
That's pretty incredible.
That's crazy.
Yo, let's do this.